tonight on Arena. We look at the man who launched Oasis, Alan McGee, and David Brophy on the life and work of Igor Stravinsky. You can text us on 51551 or tweet at RTE Arena. Igor Stravinsky is one of the most significant and most influential composers of the 20th century. Born in 1882, his music spanned a huge range of styles, perhaps reflecting the diversity of his travels and nationalities, beginning with Russian, then French, and finally American. Next Tuesday, April the 6th, marks the 50th anniversary of the death of Igor Stravinsky in New York at the age of 88. And just a few days later, on Friday, April 9th, conductor David Brophy will join forces with the RTE National Symphony Orchestra for a live stream concert from the National Concert Hall featuring some of Stravinsky's great works. Also on the programme, the very joyful and intricate Strings Astray from Belfast composer Elaine Agnew, which I know you will enjoy a little later on. But now David Brophy is with me to speak about the programme. David, let's start with Igor Stravinsky. First of all, what a remarkable life, legacy he had. We think of him as the composer of The Rite of Spring, which was so groundbreaking. But you're looking work a little later in his career. Can you just track his life after Russia?
Yeah, Kay, it's interesting because I suppose without COVID-19, we probably would be looking at the larger works like you mentioned there, The Rite of Spring and the early ballets like Petrushka and The Firebird, which called for huge orchestral forces. But he wrote for small ensembles his entire life, and the works we're going to play next week, next Friday from the National Concert Hall, they're all actually chamber works, and they're probably works that we probably wouldn't perform if we weren't in the middle of a global pandemic, because you're more inclined to play the big, well-known works. I mean, the works... Two of the works that we're going to play, the Danse Concertantes and Dumbarton Oaks, were written. One was written just before he left Europe in 1939 to go to America, and that was Dumbarton Oaks. And when he got to America, one of the earlier pieces he wrote in America was the Danse Concertantes, which he wrote in the early 1940s. And they're both for quite small ensembles. Dumbarton Oaks was written for a commission, actually a commission from a couple, Mr. and Mrs. Bliss, would you believe, who were celebrating their 30th wedding anniversary. And they had an estate, they had a house in Washington, D.C. called Dumbarton Oaks. And they commissioned Stravinsky to write a piece to celebrate the 30th wedding anniversary, which I kind of love the idea that you would do that for your 30th wedding anniversary. And it kind of sums up a little bit his life at the time. He'd gone through quite a tragic phase. His daughter had died at the end of 1938, and his wife and his mother had died within months of each other in 1939. So he was very keen, apart from the impending war, he was very keen to get out of Europe and to start a new life in America. And he was keen to take on commissions. And you're a job in composer, you got to put food on the table. I like the notion that he took commissions from all angles before he went to America.
So we listened to a little bit of from Dumbarton Oaks. This is the first movement, the Tempo Giusto, and it's the English Chamber Orchestra conducted by Sir Colin Davis. So that's Dumbarton Oaks by Igor Stravinsky. It's very upbeat, isn't it, David?
I love it. It's so innocent and playful. I mean, Stravinsky, you know, spent his entire career constructing music out of small groups of notes. Like, he would take melodies and he might take three notes and repeat the three notes for a few times here, and then he'd add another note on and you'd hear four notes the next time. It's almost like, I always think it's like building Lego. You're using Lego blocks to build pieces of music, where you've got one Lego block has like four little dots, another block has six dots, and each dot represents a note. Yeah. And he constructs these beautiful tapestries, and it's always playful. I mean, it's the one thing he lived until he was, as you said earlier on, he lived until he was 88, but he has this childlike quality his entire life, and you get the impression that, you know, when you listen to Stravinsky's music, he's actually at play, and it is very upbeat, and it always puts a smile on my face.
Yes. So could we go back to these things you call the miniatures, which are more or less exercises for the fingers, and then he builds orchestral work on top of that?
Yeah. In like a lot of composers throughout the 20th century and today, they, you know, they're all aware of how important teaching is and them being seeing themselves as pedagogues as well. So in 1921, Stravinsky wrote a series of small miniature pieces for young piano players, and I think the official title was called The Five Fingers, and if anybody who's played piano, you'll realise how, you'll understand how difficult it is with your right hand to do what's called a turn, where you're playing a scale and you've got to move your thumb under your third finger. So he wrote a series of pieces where all the melodies were only had five notes, so you just put your hand in the position on the piano where it's in and your hand stays in that position for the whole piece. It's kind of cute, so it means you don't have to turn into awkward positions. And the pieces existed for over 40 years, and in 1962 he decided to orchestrate them for a small ensemble. And they were like, if the piece, there's eight in total of these miniatures that started out as five piano pieces that he orchestrated for an ensemble of 15 players. And the last one was like a tango, and a lot of them build on, they take on nursery rhymes or dance kind of themes. So again, childlike play is at the centre of these pieces too.
Okay, we'll play some of them. Introduce us to the Andantino.
The Andantino, like as I said, the last, obviously he's got different, you know, pieces to them, and they're all the pieces are like, in total it takes 6 minutes to play the eight, mm-hmm. the eight pieces, so they're all about like 45 seconds each. The Andantino's got super legato melody on top, and it's, I just love the word he creates in this.
That's one of those Stravinsky instrumental miniatures. That's the Andantino. And that's played by the Los Angeles Chamber Orchestra. Was he in Los Angeles at this time?
He moved around, Kay. He mm-hmm. was in Hollywood for a while. He was in Los Angeles for a while. He went to America. He went to fulfill a contract at Harvard University to occupy the Charles Eliot Norton Chair of Poetry, where he gave six fantastic lectures on music in general, and that was actually his first contract, the reason he went to America in 1939. So he moved around America a bit, but he was in LA for quite a bit.
And did Hollywood come calling? Did
he actually did meet Disney, and he did when Disney was looking at producing Fantasia. I mean, Walt Disney was an amazing man in terms of reaching out across all sorts of cultures, and Walt Disney himself believed that, you know, so-called high art could be taken and could be understood by everybody, which I obviously believe to this day as well is the case. And he did court with Stravinsky. Now, their dealings, I don't think were necessarily smooth, and I think Stravinsky possibly needed, obviously he needed money to live and that, you know, but he was courted to some extent by Hollywood.
Okay, we'll listen to another one of them. This is Allegretto. They are very cinematic, aren't they?
Yeah, they're just so innocent. You know, I always get the impression he was so innocent himself. Like when he went to America first, he was really grateful to America for taking him in, as it is when he got citizenship, and for what America did to his life. You know, like, and he actually innocently went off and arranged the Star Spangled Banner as a kind of a gift of gratitude for America, which of course, if anyone knows their law, that's illegal. You can't just take the Star Spangled Banner and arrange it. And he was arrested, and if you go online, you can actually see his mugshot when he was arrested after he was arrested. But he actually, after he was arrested, he continued to perform the piece. He gave it at like 30 concerts after he was arrested. And I just love the fact that he seems to be for his whole life his own man, you know. But nevertheless, that, you know, that I think utterly beguiling childlike, you know, you can see him like in his, like in 1962, when he orchestrated those 8 miniatures, he was 80 years of age. And to write that, like, you know, he might as well have been 8 years of age when he listened to that music. It's so playful and joyful and jumping around. I love it.
Yes, and after the life he had, like fleeing communist Russia, dealing with the Belarus in his day, I mean, he had some life, and to be so playful and childlike
but
in
he
his
was,
later
he
years.
Seemed to have, like, if you watch documentaries on him online, he was had endless energy. Like, he was conducting, you know, well into his 80s. And I mean, actually, he came to Dublin in 1963. So he visited Dublin the year after he orchestrated the 8 miniatures. And he was still travelling, like, into his 80s, going around the world, conducting. Like, he conducted Symphony of Sams here in Dublin in 1963. And I just think, like, players who played under him, if you look at documentaries online from, you know, yeah, they talk about his energy. A man in his 80s who just would not stop. He was irrepressible. I think that energy can be heard in all his music.
I think we should play the third one, because this is the Tempo di Tango. Can you see the Rite of Spring, Stravinsky, in any of this?
It's there,
David?
All the way through it.
It isn't,
Kay.
It? Isn't there a bit of a...
everywhere. Like, it's, yeah, in all of those little short pieces, the fact he uses tiny little cells. I mean, I couldn't see myself doing a tango to that necessarily. It's definitely a tango through Stravinsky's eyes, you know.
Yes.
But you get it coming through at the end. And obviously the Rite of Spring, all the techniques he employed in the Rite of Spring, even though it's such a huge piece, I mean, it needs 103 players to play the Rite of Spring. Rite of Spring. It's a huge orchestra for the Rite of Spring. But you can hear the technique he uses, and the way his ways with melody, and how he turns melodies back on themselves, and maybe takes a note out here, adds a note in there, and the sounds in terms of, you know, tapping your foot are constantly shifting. You can't necessarily get to grips. You're always trying to chase where the music is, and they were the same techniques he used from the very beginning in his early ballets, the Rite of Spring included.
So that's Stravinsky, but we're going to finish up with the music that's going to open your programme by the brilliant Belfast composer Elaine Agnew. Tell us about Strings Astray.
Well, I mean, Elaine actually fits in this programme really well, because I've known Elaine for, I'm sure, about the guts of 30 years now. And she's a great spirit. Every time I meet Elaine, I mean, she never ages. She's a child in herself. She always has been a child. And her music has, you know, very actually similar energy to Stravinsky's music. It's not quite as, it doesn't move in the same melodic way. But Strings Astray actually really fits this program very well. And I mean, I'm sure she didn't write Strings Astray with Stravinsky necessarily in mind. But I think in some ways, you know, the little I know of Stravinsky, but the awful lot I know about Elaine Agnew, they are kindred spirits. They are eternally youthful people. There's a Tiernanoga quality to everything that we're going to play next Friday with the RTÉ National Symphony Orchestra, and Strings Astray certainly is well included in that programme.
We're going to play some of Strings Astray now. Tell us what to look out for.
This does exactly what it says in the tin. I mean, I think the section you're going to play is from the very end of Strings Astray. You'll get the playfulness immediately, but there's maybe a bit more of an edge to the consistency of sound here, that Stravinsky's music moves a little bit more, whereas Elaine's has more of a laser line quality, which you'll hear in this extract now.
Strings Astray there by Elaine Agnew. It must be a lovely piece to both play and conduct, David.
Yeah, no, I'm looking forward to it. I've never conducted before. It's my first time at it this week, but I know the piece for a long time.
Right, and so how are you rehearsing?
Good question. I mean, I know they've been back for the RTE National Symphony Orchestra have been back for the past few weeks. I haven't been with them since a live stream in December. I think I did some Beethoven with them then. So yeah, we rehearsed on the stage of the National Console. Obviously, there's no audience there. Everyone's socially distanced. Everyone's, I think, 2 meters apart, maybe even longer, maybe further than 2 meters apart. Everyone has masks on, apart from the woodwinds and the horns, for obvious reasons. And they've got Perspex screens around them. And I have a mask on, and everyone feels like we're a million miles away from each other. And it's, I know, we started doing some live streams last September after many months of not being able to do anything. The first thing that we noticed it was difficult was trying to hear everybody, because you're so far away from everybody and you're used to like being close together. If you sit in the middle of an orchestra, you've got sound coming from all directions, and then suddenly, you know, you kind of feel a lot of, particularly string players, I think they feel like they're playing on their own. They're kind of in the middle of nowhere. Where's everybody? I'm used to sharing a music stand with my desk partner, you know. So everyone, all the string players have their own music stand. Normally they share stands. And so it's a bit different.
And do you find it difficult to conduct with being restricted by having the mask on?
I find it difficult to conduct anyway, Kay. this is lifelong learning for me, you know. I wouldn't say it's difficult. I'd say it's just different. And yeah, I think we all have to listen differently, you know. And I think at times, you know, where, you know, you'd find, there's sometimes when I find the orchestra in the current setup we have, that you might call it the COVID setup, you know, they kind of need a bit more help, as this is where things are, because they can't hear each other. And other times, if we weren't in this COVID setup, they could just play things on their own without me. I wouldn't get in the way, you know. I spend most rehearsals trying to work out, when do they actually need me, and when can I step back and they can do things themselves, you know. So.
And when you're deciding what to play, like for this concert series, yes, now, do you sit around a table with the other music people and say, how many musicians can we get away with certain pieces by Stravinsky?
God, Kay, I love your questions. These are questions I can't answer at all, because, well, I know for these concerts, since the live stream started happening last September, obviously there are meetings between management at the RTE National Symphony, yeah, Orchestra and the National Concert Hall, because, you know, there's so many protocols, and we're all hyper careful to do the right thing here. No one wants to put anybody in any risk here. So there are, and these are meetings that I'm not privy to, actually. So they just kind of ring me after and say, yes, we've got a meeting and we can get this number of players on stage. And actually, it's not as simple as that. Actually, we're actually only allowed a certain number of people in the building, in the entire building, the National Concert Hall. I think we're only allowed 40 people in the entire building.
Yes, that's in the entire
concert hall.
Concert
in the entire,
yeah,
building. So even when people tune into to the live stream on Friday week at 7 p.m, there are people who are not on stage who are part of our cohort of 40 people. So I think we can get maybe 34 on stage. I think maybe I've got that wrong,
right.
Maybe 30, 34, around that, and so that obviously dictates what we can play, because we can't play the big stuff, the Rite of Spring, with 103 players, obviously, for obvious reasons.
Well, it sounds a fantastic programme. David Brophy, thank you so much.
Pleasure, Kate.
Thank you. David Brophy will be conducting the RTE National Symphony Orchestra in a live stream concert from the National Concert Hall, featuring the work of Igor Stravinsky and Irish composer Elaine Agnew. That takes place at 7 p.m. on Friday, April 9th. It will be live streamed on rte.ie/culture and broadcast live on RTE Lyric FM. You're listening to Tuesday Night's Arena.
Just what is it that you want to do?
Well, we want to be free. We want to be free to do what we want to do. And we want to get loaded. And we want to have a good time. And that's what we're going to do.
Well, wait, baby, let's go.
We're going to have a good time. We're going to have a party.
Now available on Sky Cinema, Creation Stories takes us back to Britain in the 1990s, the era of Britpop, the acid house scene, Tony Blair and New Labour. It tells the story of Alan McGee, the music label he founded, Creation Records, and the bands he signed, among them Oasis, Jesus and Mary Chain, My Bloody Valentine, and as we heard there, singing Loaded, Primal Scream. Creation Stories is based on McGee's 2013 memoir of the same name, directed by actor Nick Moran, and has a strong Trainspotting pedigree. Ewan Bremner plays Alan McGee, Irving Welch and Dean Kavanagh are responsible for the screenplay, and Denny Boyle has an executive producing role. Eamon Sweeney has been watching it for us, and he joins me now. Eamon, you were a teenager in the 1990s, the perfect age to be Primal Scream, Jesus and Mary Chain, Oasis fan, were you?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I remember vividly when that track you just played, Primal Scream, Loaded. I suppose kind of it's often said that the 90s really began when the Stone Roses and Happy Mondays were on the same episode of Top of the Pops in late 1989. And the late Andy Weatherall, who died tragically and very suddenly last year, remixed that track that you just played. There was an old Primal Scream song and completely reinvented it. And the subsequent album, Screamadelica, that came out in September 1991 when I was 15. And straight after that, or a few weeks after that, Creation Records put another album out. It was by a Dublin band called My Bloody Valentine. It was called Loveless. And then that was followed, if that wasn't enough, Bandwagon-esque by Teenage Fan Club, a defining album, just, you know, joyous power pop. And I think really that autumn, listening to music, those three records from the same label, for me, marked the moment of being a casual music fan to really being an obsessive music fan. Like, it's just outstanding music, even 30 years later.
Well, let's do what they do in Creation Stories a lot. Let's rewind and start with Alan McGee. Who was he and what made him so good at picking bands?
Alan McGee, for a start, he was in bands. None of them, like Biff Bang Pow and the Laughing Apple, none of them had much success, but they're independent bands in Scotland. It was when he was a teenager, a boy called Bobby Gillespie knocked on his door, and he knew from Alan used to kind of walk around town with Bowie albums under his arm that he was a music fan.
Mm-hmm.
And Bobby Gillespie was a little younger than Alan, wasn't allowed to go to a gig on his own, and Thin Lizzy were playing the Barrows, the famous Barrowlands in Glasgow. So a lifelong friendship began, and also Bobby ended up being in the Jesus and Mary Chain and another early Creation band. And so what made him so good? I suppose he was blessed with the company, you know, kind of like if your induction, you know, at an early age is from another figure like that, who incidentally is penning his own memoir that's going to be out in October called Tenement Kid by Bobby Gillespie. What made Alan so good was he was surrounded by these people, but also he was manna to the music press in the late 80s and early 90s. You know, even long before Oasis came on the scene, that's, you know, that brought it to mm-hmm. a completely, a whole new level. I just remember reading the NME and Melody Maker and Sounds and all that stuff back then. And he was always in the music press. He was always hyping up something. He was always enthusing. He was this larger than life character and such a strong personality, a little bit in the mold of the late Tony Wilson, you know, who were Factory Records in Manchester mm-hmm. with Joy Division and New Order and the Happy Mondays and so on. A little bit in that mold, but, you know, with a very different personality and a very strong personality. He just seemed to have a Midas touch.
Yes, he definitely had a motor mouth. Here, Ewan Bremner, as Alan McGee, recalls his early days managing bands and his first hearing an early demo from Primal Scream.
Let's rewind. Club in London, getting a decent turnout for the club, recording demos for the bands that ask, signing, pressing and selling records for the ones that we fucking love. In Glasgow, word is, we're big time. Charlie's down in London. Bobby is putting Primal Scream together with Innes, who's getting over losing his kidney. He gets given a demo to give to me. Interesting racket. Velvets meets the Stooges. We come down to do a gig. Joe does the sound, but Joe had worked his way through a bag of Pink Speed and hadn't slept in days. Chaos, straight off. But I loved it. Signed him.
Yeah, quite fresh language there from Ewan Bremner as Alan McGee. But it's hard not to get a clip from Creation Stories without very fresh and unsavoury language from Alan McGee. He was quite a character, wasn't he? And he talked about that notion of the bands he liked were the bands who could create excitement.
Oh, absolutely. He really was. He was a character that kind of, you know, I remember the first time I interviewed him, and it would have been in the early noughties, and he was exactly as what I expected. He was exactly that figure, that motor mouth that I've been reading in the music press for so many years. He was that. And he partied hard. And you know, the parties in the old Creation offices in Hackney, London, were legendary, that bands would be summoned in for maybe a meeting on a Friday afternoon, and they'd be kind of leaving on a Monday morning, you know, wondering what on earth was all that about? Did we get anything done? Mm-hmm. Was there anything agreed to, and so on? That's how he kind of did business. And so I suppose with something, you know, when it's that chaotic, of course it's going to go a bit wrong. And it does go wrong for Alan, as is, you know, very clearly documented in the movie. And it does go wrong for the label. They essentially need to get, you know, bailed out by Sony. But then what does he do? He discovers, quite literally, the biggest band in the world.
Yeah, tell us the story about, if it is the truth, of how he discovered Oasis. But it all starts with missing a train and what he did after that.
Yeah, actually, I did speak to Alan last week about, and he actually confessed that the missing the train part is nonsense. But anyway, what is true that he was kind of like at a gig in King Tut's, a very famous, well, subsequently a very famous a small venue in Glasgow. And it was kind of like an unsigned night, and he was kind of there more to catch up with a pal. You know, obviously he was still an eye out for talent. And as quite a pivotal scene in the movie kind of shows, Oasis, that legend has it, you know, weren't supposed to be on the bill, had just kind of showed up and blagged their way to get to a slot. So they were kind of on first, playing to three men and a dog. And McGee is kind of at the back of the room, listening to his friend, but then suddenly goes, wait a second, I like this. And you kind of see him walk towards the front of the stage as the character playing Liam Gallagher is singing Rock and Roll Star. And the rest is kind of history. Pretty much when Oasis were packing up their gear, and Alan McGee approached Noel Gallagher and said, would you like a record deal? And Noel Gallagher knew he was a roadie within Spiral Carpets, knew exactly who Alan McGee was, just said, yeah. And that's pretty much it.
And in Creation Stories, how does that come across? Do you think it gets that excitement? Does it capture the evening?
Yeah, it does. It does. It's a very fast-paced movie. It's a very, very funny movie. It's a very foul-mouthed movie, as we've just seen in that clip. There's a lot of energy to it. In terms of flaws, it's probably just with the whole, you know, fact-fiction, myth-making, megalomania, too much drugs, too much partying, and so on. And McGee has pretty much confessed that it's about 50% factual. And when he says factual, it happened, but it didn't exactly happen like that. So a lot of creative license has been taken. But the end result is it's something very entertaining. And I think, I would hope that it's something else that's going to be inspiring for younger musicians, and not just for middle-aged people like me on a nostalgia trip. And I think that's a very important thing. There's nothing wrong about nostalgia. There's nothing wrong about revisiting the past and the songs of one's youth. But, you know, I would hate this movie to then kind of like imply, and I don't think it does, by the way, that this was kind of the pinnacle of music of its era, and they don't make them like they used to anymore, and all that kind of nonsense that the old conservative punks kind of came out with, and kind of, oh, we fought through the punk wars and music these days is no good. If anything, music today is much more diverse, and in the UK and indeed here, and, you know, people from marginalised communities, you've got grime, you've got drill, black working class musicians are talking about their own concerns, their own anxieties. The Britpop era was very much, you know, a white, blokey, new lad, kind of Larry kind of thing, but with some great songs.
Yeah, but it's hard also to talk about the period without talking about New Labour and without talking about Tony Blair. And of course, Alan McGee with the cajoled Oasis to get involved and to go famously to 10 Downing Street. So in this clip, Alan McGee and partner Kate Holmes get the invitation to Chequers, the country residence of the UK Prime Minister Tony Blair, a place where all manner of celebrity is rubbing shoulders with the politicians.
We helped them win. We were invited to the podium. Everybody saw us on TV. It's all part of the circus.
But then came the invite to Chequers, the very private country residence of the incumbent Prime Minister.
Hello, hello.
To walk in the footsteps of leaders and kings, or Churchill, Eisenhower, Gorbachev.
Tony used to be in the band.
Yes, I helped him about that.
Great thinkers and world leaders discussed means of peace and laws for the betterment of mankind.
Now, Kate, come and let me show you around our little pad. You'll love it. See you boys later.
A wee ginger tool from Glasgow.
What else you got here, Tony?
Oh, it's a bit of sensations for my system. Yes, it is, man.
In the court of kings.
I get started on this new deal for unemployed musicians as soon as possible, please.
Right, yes. Chris Smith's your man.
Now then.
Sir Jimmy.
Anthony, right here, boy.
Oh. Oh, have you met Alan McGee?
I do not believe. He has had the pleasure.
Jimmy Savile.
Got it. Mr. Britpop, I presume.
So Ewan Bremner there as Alan McGee, Charlie Murphy as Kate Holmes, James Payton as Tony Blair, Claire Kasan as Sherry Blair and Alistair McGowan as Jimmy Savile. Did that work for you, the 10 Downing Street stuff and the trying to get Oasis and other bands on board?
Yeah. It absolutely, because I remember it very well, the kind of whole commotion that when Noel Gallagher and Alan McGee were pictured walking into number 10, that there was immediately a backlash about this. And famously, Damon Albarn turned down an invite saying that he was a communist and to enjoy the schmooze, comrades. And over the years, it's something that's kind of, you know, become a whole... myth in itself, but it is a fascinating moment in British pop cultural history, and I think it's captured very well in the movie. And then bringing in the Jimmy Savile thing, which I think is very much also a kind of a writing device from Irving Welsh, you know, that Savile kind of features quite you know, occasionally to and frequently kind of in his work from Ecstasy onwards. And it is a fascinating, quite, you know, we don't, like Britpop kind of began with that hobnobbing and Tony Blair and that famous photo of Alan McGee and Noel and Blair.
Okay.
And also Liam Gallagher and Patsy Kensit on the cover of Vanity Fair. I think that all ended in divorce and the whole kind of Blair thing ended in invading Iraq. Like looking back on it all now, it was a mad kind of pop culture moment.
Okay, well, we want to finish by playing a little bit from Oasis. This is Slide Away from Definitely Maybe. Slide Away from Oasis. My thanks to Eamon Sweeney. Creation Stories is available on Sky Cinema. You're listening to Arena. Alas, what wickedness to swallow flesh into our own flesh, to fatten our greedy bodies by cramming in other bodies, to have one living creature fed by the death of another. Those words are by the Roman poet Ovid, but they are what frame a new collection of contemporary poems by Victoria Kenefick, who is in this her first collection, unflinchingly looks at the human body and the lengths it will go to fuel and fast and cannibalise its flesh and the flesh of others. Eat or We Both Starve is the title of Victoria Kenefick, and Ken, she joins me now. Victoria, if the epigram by Ovid wasn't strong enough beer, the first poem in the collection sets the tone with a pretty shocking reading of an everyday event. Do you think poetry should be give you a good shock?
I was listening earlier today to an interview Claire Byrne did with a gentleman, I can't remember his name now, about water therapy and shocking yourself with cold water in order to reduce inflammation and to feel better. And I just thought how, well, I need to try that firstly, but also how relevant it was to reflection, because I think poetry can do so many different things. I think it can comfort, I think it can reassure, but also I think it has the ability to shock, and I think sometimes it's good to be shocked. And I think this poem, you know, shocks on many levels. I suppose it's quite visceral and it's quite dramatic and quite gross, one might say. But I suppose I was looking at inverting traditional tropes of cannibalism, and certainly around the Catholic Church as well, you know, an inversion of eating Christ's body, because here the speaker consumes the female body, maybe even the Virgin Mary, or certainly the archetypical female body, and maybe the devouring mother, an inversion of that. So I think it's kind of setting the tone for the rest of the book, looking at, as the book does, issues around, as you mentioned, the body and consumption, capitalism, religion, the family, all of these things. So it's kind of consuming the collective unconscious as well.
Right. So the title of that first poem is Learning to Eat My Mother, Where My Mother is the Teacher. So will you read that for us?
I'd be delighted to. Learning to Eat My Mother, Where My Mother is the Teacher. Where did I start? Yes. With the heart enlarged, its chambers stretched through caring. In this body, feeling is what the body is. The alert heart, an alarm rings out in all hours of the night, flashing red and white. Oh, is it in defiance or defeat? I don't know. I eat it anyway, raw, still warm. The size of my fist, I love it. Strange, a vegetarian resorting to cannibalism. He is disgusted with me. Wouldn't you begin with the outside? Sweating, I pry open the rib cage. I do not want to eat her ribs, but I do. Then strip her fingers of meat. I hold them tenderly in my mouth, watch her blue eyes well up out of love, I assume. I move from heart to ribs, fingers to spongy lungs, buoyant, porous, melt in the mouth. The eyes are tougher than expected. Aqueous humour slithers down my throat. A surprise. It's minty. I know what you're thinking. I left the brain. No, not so. I have consumed that organ piecemeal. Sweet morsel since my teeth came in. It tastes like the sound of sirens you don't know are screaming until they suddenly stop.
Learning to Eat My Mother, Where My Mother is the Teacher, from Victoria Kenefick's Eat or We Both Starve. My goodness, it's a dog-eat-dog world out there, however you view life. You also say in Researching the Famine, another one of the poems, that all we do is eat, as though that were just commonplace. But you take such verbal joy in describing consumption. Is that because you think we need to get a bit of a jolt about how blasé we are about eating?
To an extent, certainly, I think that's true. And I suppose it's about the mindlessness of the way that we consume not only food and being a vegetarian. I suppose that's something I'm very aware of, how people consume meat I don't judge it. Let me preface that.
I think you might.
maybe I do. I try very much not to. Certainly, the poems when I wrote them, maybe tell a different story. I think it's maybe about the awareness that we bring to how we consume not only food, but I think how we consume idealized versions of what it means to be a woman, and how we consume young women and their coming of age stories, and really try and appropriate them for our own means. And so I think this book, in many respects, is a coming of age book about what it means to be a young woman growing up in a world where the world wants to eat you. And I think, in a sense, what I'm doing is I'm biting back.
Yes, and it's very interesting too, the how you approach young women and this almost threat that their body is under, and how in medieval times women took the notion of starving their body or doing extreme things with their bodies to in some way give themselves some kind of power.
Very much so. And there's a broken sequence, I call it, in the book, which is a collection of poems about these saints and martyrs from the medieval period and beyond. And they certainly engaged in very extreme behaviours around eating, around self-flagellation, around self-harm, that obviously when we look back at that, we would view it, I think, now as being, you know, a huge cause of worry and indeed, you know, perhaps indicating significant mental health issues. But then it was, as you say, and maybe even now, a way of gaining power, and a way, I suppose, of shrinking back on one level to preserve the self, maybe free of emotional entanglements because they were women of religion, and it being a strategy of survival and perhaps the only way that they could survive. And indeed, many of them that did go through this dreadful, I suppose, sequence of self-harm, like with anorexia and so on, they actually thrived later on, if they did survive it, becoming, you know, quite significantly important members of the institutional Catholic Church.
Yes, we're talking about people like St. Catherine of Siena, who would have starved herself and then had well, that she levitated and went into a form of ecstasy from the starvation, which made her, in probably the eyes of the Church, saintly.
Exactly. And I suppose it is, as you say, it's kind of taking that power back. And I suppose we're so comfortable with our self-indulgence, especially with Easter coming up, that I think there is this fascination and maybe discomfort around denial. And I think particularly in today's culture, we're very uncomfortable with that idea for many reasons, historical and cultural and societal. But I think that it's very interesting looking at those women from that perspective and how they use their bodies maybe as being the only way that they had to express themselves and to be powerful, as you say.
Now, again, in your fantastic collection, Eat or We Both Starve, there are extremes, Victoria. And when it comes to Veronica Giuliani, she fairly goes for it. Will you read Hunger Strike by Victoria Giuliani for us, please?
Hunger Strikes, Veronica Giuliani, 1660 to 1727. My confessor ordered her to do it. The novice kicked me again and again. Her shoe pummeled my teeth, bloodied my lips. I did not stir or whimper. I kept my mouth open. I remained bruised for weeks. When my face was almost pink again, he prompted me to clean the walls and floor of my cell with my tongue. I licked for hours, scraping up each wisp of skin and hair. My throat became thick with cobwebs, my mind clear as light.
Fantastic. That's Hunger Strike by Hunger Strike Victoria Giuliani from Victoria Kenefick's Eat or We Both Starve. And as you say, that's a series of hunger strikes that go along, ending up with yourself. Now, it's not often we come across a collection of poetry that celebrates people like Catherine of Siena, but Audrey Hepburn, Mary Tyler Moore. Where does Mary Tyler Moore come in? Is she another kind of iconic woman who did something with either her appearance or her clothing to try and keep her own power?
Yes, I think with both of those characters, Mary Tyler Moore and Audrey Hepburn, they had this particular kind of star quality, obviously, but also a very unthreatening femininity that was palatable, I think, to audiences and to network executives and moviegoers at the time, that they were beautiful, that they were friendly, that they were non-threatening, and that allowed them to a certain degree maybe to infiltrate the enemy lines, if you like, and to move the narrative forward, I think, in terms of what was expected of women at the time and what women were allowed, quote unquote, to do. So in my Mary Tyler Moore poem, for example, she has the audacity to wear pants when at the time it was never really shown on television before that a 1960s housewife would be, you know, wearing pants doing housework. She's still doing the housework, of course. So things had a long way to come. Equally with Audrey Hepburn, I think I'm really fascinated by her, particularly, I suppose, because I loved her as a child and looked up to her as being the absolute epitome of feminine perfection. You know, so beautiful, so doe-eyed, so elegant, so graceful. And of course, underneath all of that, grappling with her own issues around anorexia, she developed during rationing in World War II, her difficulties, you know, not making it as a ballerina. And all of these things that she was struggling with that I had no idea when I was a child and a younger person. And I idealized her. And I think that was lovely in one sense, but also, again, quite damaging in terms of what I expected of myself.
Well, we'd love you to read Prayer to Audrey Hepburn, if you would, just to finish,
of
Victoria.
Course. Prayer to Audrey Hepburn. O blessed Audrey of the feline eye flick, jutting bones, slim-hipped androgyny of wartime rationing, I've missed your nightly visitations. I summoned you, carefully cutting around your monochrome face in Mother's fashion magazines, pointing the scissors away from myself as I had been taught, your name an incantation on my lips. I stuck those pieces of you to my pink walls with rolled up sellotape and waited. You came, sheathed in black with the posture of a reed. Hypnotized, I prayed to you for grace that I could sew my mouth closed like a doll, be a sculpture made of skin. Years later, and there's a person growing in my uterus, my body a building site. I intercede to you again, snip around your slinky silhouette. In scissors blades, I see myself 13. When you fall out of the shadows, oh, Audrey. Can't stay, you hiss. You stare at me with saucer eyes. I am hungry, you say, hungry like you. I can't help but laugh. I am too big to be a woman. You lean over the bed. I am conscious of my pudgy belly, my rat's nest hair, but you take my face in your hands, kiss me hard, pushing your gorgeous tongue across the length of mine. Afterwards, our seams popping, we shriek with laughter.
Victoria Kinnifig there, reading Prayer to Audrey Hepburn from Eat or We Both Starve, and that's published by Carcanet Press. Victoria, thank you so much. That's it for tonight's show. The programme was researched by Paula Shields. Mark McGrath was on sound. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Tonight's show was produced by Sinead E.